Medical Center in Glen Oaks. When I finally get to Glen Oaks, you see it a lot on you. So, I don't know. Maybe it's time for a visit. K2IW, K2J.
C2TZG.
Sorry about before when I let out a curse. That was my mistake, and I doubled with somebody. Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Zulu Golf. Name here is Joe Graves in Brooklyn. Send me a ticket if you want.
Not sure what you're worried about. We never heard a thing. Yes, when you went to the hospital, you did have some hiss. And then when you went to the non-hospital, the hiss went away. But occasionally there was a crackly there. So right now when I'm running low power, you hear some occasional cracklies in the background. When I go to higher power, the cracklies almost disappear. I guess I'm capturing a little bit more of the discriminator. Okay, we're getting smarter. Alrighty, Ed, I wonder if you have any further questions about lightning arrestor, Ed. KD2KNL, K2LIW. You've got it, Ed.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They won't handle a lightning strike, or does it mean that you can no longer transmit, you know?
Ed, you picked up before the beeps took place, and therefore you timed out. But now you've got a further question for Eric. You've got a further question for Eric about the lightning arrestors. So wait for the beeps. Re-ask your question to Eric. This time he'll hear it. KD2KNL, wait for the beeps. K2LIW in the TechNet.
I'm sorry about that. KD2KNL here. Yeah, so Eric, what I wanted to ask you was, when you said about these lightning arrestors failing after they get a potential lightning strike or something, when they fail, does that mean that it won't protect you against a lightning strike, or does it mean that you can't transmit on it, you know, it's going to block your transmission?
No, they'll still operate normally, as you would transmit and receive, but they're no longer effective in protecting your equipment.
So, as I think you're saying, that the gas discharge device might become damaged, it might be blasted into an open circuit, and that sub-module has to be replaced. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Wait for the beeps. I didn't.
Yeah, the gas discharge devices hold up better than the MOVs. The MOVs, you know, they're one-shot deals. And you'll find in some of them there's like a whole string of them with the hope to protect the, you know, getting continued protection, so you only whack one of them, but that's usually never the case. And if you want to see the results of them, I have a lot of them. Don't forget, I get whacked by lightning a lot here, and I have them on various different devices, and every now and then I get them put on a iPod tester to see if they still work. but yeah, the solid state lightning protectors, like even the power strips that have surge protectors on them, they're built out of MOVs. And usually after two or three surges, most people won't realize that they don't protect you from surges anymore. So that's just part of the course. When you're dealing with that much energy in that small a space, you know, something bad's going to happen.
Yes, what you said, Eric, is that the MOVs in particular, once they take a hit, they're probably fairly useless after that. These MOVs, by the way, metal oxide thyristor, I think is what the MOV stands for. It looks like a very large disc ceramic capacitor with two radial leads coming out of it. And so it looks like a great big capacitor across your 110-volt line or whatever other line you're protecting. And when you said, Eric, that I have a whole lot of them here that got blasted, in your case, the word here has got at least two meanings. One of your words here could be your broadcast center of Channel 21, where you've got this 350-foot high tower on 250-foot land, and it gets struck by lightning and you get a lot of damage. The other word here could be your private residence. In the case of your private residence, I'll bet you that it's not your antenna being struck. I'll bet you it's the 110-volt power line, so to speak, somewhere in your neighborhood, maybe 3 miles away, that gets struck, and a great big surge enters your house and blasts your MOVs. So when you said the word here, which here did you mean? And are you getting MOVs being blasted in your private residence? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K268. No, I'm at the broadcast authority. There's a 300-foot stick here, which is a big lightning rod. But that's not where the one that really keeps you busy. It's when we used to be at the World Trade Center. That's in one place, because of the way that's structured. They're also at Empire, but they don't seem to have that much of an issue with Empire, because the mooring mast, on top of the mooring mast, is a whole lot of power, and that's really well grounded. The only thing that's there is the transmission antenna, which is not such a big deal, because if you've ever seen how that's made, you can hit it with lightning all you want. And it barely bugs your transmitter, especially after all the cavities it's going to pass through. No, I'm talking about like on the World Trade Center, even here where we've got, sticks that are exposed just as much as the main mast is. So you may not actually get a direct strike to say a station master, but you do pick up a lot of energy when the main antenna gets whacked.
Yeah, you being in charge of being essentially the chief engineer, as I can tell, for PBS local channel 13 from New York Central, channel 21 in Plainview. Make me a rough guess, Eric. Back in the days of the World Trade Center, rough guess, how many times per year do you think World Trade Center was struck with lightning? Now you do a lot of operating from the Empire State Building for channel 13. Make a rough guess, how many times per year is Empire State Building struck with lightning? And you also dwell at the Broadcast Center for Channel 21 in Plainview. Roughly how many times per year is the antenna structure in Plainview struck with lightning? Give me a rough guess on any of those if you happen to know. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, as far as Plainview goes, this year we actually didn't get hit at all. Last year I think there were like 5 hits. The year before that was 2 hits, and then before that was a whole bunch, and then I can't remember past that. As far as World Trade Center goes, every time there's really intense thunderstorms, you know it's going to get hit multiple times in one night, usually. All you got to do is do a Google search for lightning in World Trade Center, lightning in Empire, and you'll see there's lots of them. But don't forget, there's structures are designed to take it, so to speak. After all, they are the tallest things around. Let's put it this way, in the World Trade Center, when you go out on the roof and look down, you can see the helicopters flying below you. And then, of course, there's time for it, totally cloudy, and when you're looking at the buildings, you can't see past the 40th floor, so. There's a lot of a lot of capability of energy being drawn off by a big stick. KE2RIW.
Very interesting. So your 300-foot tall structure on 250-foot land in Plainview, it was not struck at all this year. I think you said it was struck twice last year and three times before that. By what means, Eric, do you know how many times the Plainview structure was struck? Is it some kind of recording equipment, or is that how often you have to do some form of damage replacement? What's your way of finding out how often Plainview is struck, because sometimes that lightning is striking it when you're not there? KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
Well, I generally know by, we record the output of the transmitters and visual and that kind of stuff. When there's a lightning hit, you see it affect everything. But usually it takes me about 5 or 10 minutes to be able to hear again and take a deep breath with the compression that you feel and the noises that you hear. So I've been there in the room a lot of times when it's gotten hit. And at World Trade, that's another interesting story, because the transmitters are on the 110th floor, and directly above you usually are some ports with little cables and stuff where the 8-inch coax works its way out to the roof. When there's a change in air pressure, you generally feel it in the room, so when something gets hit there, you know about it. But yeah, I'm sure that there's been strikes where I didn't actually notice that they existed, but the ones I'm talking about, I know about.
W-H-C-D-O.
Wait for the beeps, and you've got it, Andy. W-H-C-D-O, go right ahead.
Good evening, both. The crackle is not on your signal. It's on the repeater. I'm hearing you on the input, and I'm actually seeing it on the repeater.
And I'm even hearing some crackling on your signal, Andy. And you're a lot closer to the repeater than I am. So it looks like there's some cracklies at the repeater site itself, Eric. And I think that's what you said. You might have to do some visiting. KE2EJ, KQRAW. What you need is more tasks, Eric. But thank goodness you've got this great big staff of people that help you out doing all this maintenance. You got it, Eric.
Andy, you don't hear a nav, do you? Although my signal into this receiver is noisy.
I do. I hear it on you, but a lot less. You're covering it up a lot more than Dick is, but it's there.
Okay, so I had to take a little time of troubleshooting here. What do you hear now?
I hear that. Give me some more. Give me another like, so 10 seconds or 15 seconds.
WHCDL, K2J, here's 10 seconds of silence. I'm just trying to isolate where it's coming from.
I don't hear it on... I'm just listening. I don't hear it on you at that time. I didn't hear it.
Okay. So, it looks like we're getting it from two separate receivers. This one's fine. Okay, let's go over to this guy over here. Come on.
The last transmission you made, I heard you on the input, but you weren't coming through the repeater, Eric. That is to say, your audio wasn't coming through the repeater, even though your carrier was apparently coming through. You got it, Eric.
Good. Let's see. That's this one. Let's go over here. Hello, a two. You hear the noise here?
Yes, we are hearing the noise there, and I'm hearing the noise on my signal at the same time. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. All right. And how about here? You hearing the noise here? Forget about the hiss, the crackly noise.
Just like you said, a little bit of hiss, but no crackly noise. And I'm hearing no crackly noise on my signal, but a little bit of hiss also. You've got it, Eric.
Okay, so we know which receiver it is. Now, I've got it turned off, which will not be helpful for people to the west, but let's see what happens. KQRAW, K2J.
I don't think you've got to turn that one off, Eric. The fact is a little bit of crackles, but it's working. That's not bad. We're hearing the guy's audio very well. And so with that receiver turned off, certain people are going to have trouble getting in. So it's your choice. Okay. I think we've answered most of Ed's questions. Now we're going to go over to Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Eugene, I hope you had a chance to go over the material from Glenn, November 6, Juliet, November 6, George, Nancy, and 6GN. N2XJN.
Yes, I did. I reviewed the material of N6GN. N6GN, if you go to his website, go to QRZ.com, and I think you can find the email addresses of his website, you'll see where he's done experiments with a single wire transmission line. Some people call it a G line or a Gabu line. Gubau lines pronounced in various different ways. It's a classic kind of transmission line that was studied, I believe, in the early 40s, where you could literally take, say, for instance, a piece of RG8 coaxial cable and strip away the outer polyvinyl jacket, strip away the outer braided shield, leave the polyethylene insulation, and leave the semiconductor. That single wire transmission line with a layer of dielectric material if you have the right kind of conic conic launching structure on the input end of that single wire transmission line, and if you have a single, have another kind of launching structure that looks like a great big cone with the wire going down the center as the receiving structure, the single wire G line is a rather low loss microwave transmission line. The good news is that it has relatively low loss. The bad news is you've got to be careful how you suspend it, sort of like a great big catenary. You don't want to make any sharp bends in it, otherwise it'll start radiating at the bends. And the individual cones that do the launching and receiving, they're not perfectly well shielded. If you had nearby sensitive transmitting or receiving equipment, you would get some QR Mary, you would get some interference from a G line, because it's not a thoroughly shielded structure. A coaxial cable is a very well shielded structure. Let me drop.
Repeater, time out.
Properly used twin lead or open wire transmission line, even though it looks very open to your eye, because if it's being properly used in a thoroughly differential manner, that means at one instant of time, you may have plus 50 volts on the right-hand wire, and you have minus 50 volts on the left-hand wire. As open as that looks to a radio wave, that's an extremely well-shielded structure because of that balanced, fully differential characteristic. But in the case of a G line, where there's only one wire there, it is nowhere near as well-shielded. So because of the degree of difficulty of setting it up and using it correctly, because it's not very well-shielded, even though it has low insertion loss compared to other kinds of transmission lines of a similar amount of material, it is not popular. And so N6GN ran a set of experiments in which he measured the insertion loss of something like 100 or 300 feet of this line. And when he comes to calculating the insertion loss, he came up with a very low number as he swept from something like 100 megahertz up to 1,000 megahertz. Let me drop. But there's a catch. In his calculation and measurement of what he thought was the insertion loss of his single wire transmission line, he believes he has a transverse magnetic, not a TEM. By the way, when you feed signal into a coax cable, it is a TEM signal. When you feed signal into twin lead, it is a TEM signal. When you feed a signal that you transmit into free space, it is a TEM signal. When you feed a signal down a single wire transmission line, I think he calls it a transverse magnetic. In other words, there's an E-field component along the wire. As far as explaining the transmission itself, but what I was getting at is that he ran this experiment, and as he swept it from roughly 100 megs to 1,000 megs, he came up with a relatively low insertion loss. That makes it look very desirable, but there's a catch. He assigned roughly 2 dB of loss for the launching structure and roughly 2 dB of loss for the receiving structure. And I've got a problem with that, because if he's built the launching structure out of low loss material, solid piece of copper sheeting, so to speak, where in the world is the 2 dB insertion loss coming from? He doesn't explain it as a input standing wave ratio. He doesn't explain it as local radiation in the free space independent of the single wire transmission line. So where did the 2 dB of loss come from? If he uses a 2 dB of loss calculation on the input end and 2 dB of loss on the launching structure for the output end, and what he's left over with the total system loss comes out with very desirable numbers. But that 2 dB of loss for the launching structure, that gives me problems. So although he's running a very interesting set of experiments...
Repeater, timeout.
Although he's running a very interesting set of experiments of insertion loss versus frequency of this transmitting structure, of this transmission line structure, as I said, the 2 dB of loss of launching on each end, that's troublesome to me. It shouldn't be there. If I built my antenna tuner out of low loss materials, it has essentially no insertion loss. if I built my launching structure out of low-loss material. It should have no insertion loss. If I put 100 watts into the structure of his, and it has 2 dB of loss, if it's real loss, I could go over there with my thermometer and measure how hot it is. He didn't do that. What's the mechanism of loss if it's not getting hot? If the mechanism loss is radiation into free space, independent of the transmission line, that's undesirable. Because in most cases, when you've got a transmission line, you would like the signal to flow 99.99% down the transmission line. If some of it's also flowing into free space, that's not a very well-shielded structure, and it's going to be giving you electromagnetic interference to local sensitive radio equipment. So, good sounding experiment, some missing information, and from what he has presented so far with his experiments, I don't think a whole lot of people are going to jump onto that particular bandwagon saying that that's the transmission line I've been looking for, now I'm going to go do that. I don't think a whole lot of people are going to jump on that bandwagon so far. That's my first assessment on what I saw with those YouTube videos that he's presenting, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. But a few other things. At first, he says that it is not global line. And it looks like he's an inventor of something new happening this year. Let me jump. Second thing is you forgot to mention about the disks are just nearby near the cone and the role of those disks. And the third thing is the PM wave having a signal leave here. Back to you.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of hits on your signal tonight, Wes. You're putting in a fairly weak signal to whichever one of the sites is receiving your signal. Also, your audio is lower than normal. So you might want to speak a little bit closer to the microphone. Now, the disc...
How is it now? Is it better?
Better in both ways. You're putting in a stronger signal and a lot more audio.
Thank you.
And so, yes, his line was not quite a G-line. G-line normally is a conductor with a certain thickness of dielectric material around the conductor. He wasn't using the extra dielectric material. I think he was speculating that the 10,000th of an inch of rust on the outside was somehow giving him the insulated material. But his particular single wire line, I think he's also had an article in QEX a couple of years ago about a new kind of radio transmission which had E-field in the direction of transmission. Whenever you transmit a wave in free space, a radio wave, all of the history we know of up till now and all the mathematics we know of up till now is that signal must be a TEM signal. In other words, the signal you transmit into free space has to have an E-field component, an H-field component, and both of those are exactly at right angles to the direction of propagation. And he set up cone-like antennas in his QEX article, in which he believes he was transmitting a different kind of wave into free space, which had a E-field component in the direction of transmission. And he ran a set of experiments that he thought confirmed that. And some people were very skeptical about that. There's good reason to believe that any radio wave... Let me drop... Any radio wave you transmit into free space must be TEM, and that any method of transmission that creates a E-field component or an H-field component in the direction of transmission, that component will very rapidly die out a couple of feet away from your transmitting antenna. That's what most people who have studied radio, that's what they believe. So that you, in free space, it's got to be TEM. Inside of a waveguide, yes. You can have an E-field component or an H-field component in the direction of propagation. But that's because the signal is bouncing back and forth of the walls of a waveguide. In free space, you don't have that. So, he believes that on his wire, he's now supporting this other mode of transmission, which is not TEM. It's got a component in the E-field of the in the direction of the wire.
He's talking about pointing vector.
The word pointing vector is E crossed H, where E and H are at right angles to each other and at right angles to the direction of transmission. That's the usual definition of pointing vector. He has his own individual definition of pointing vector, which is non-conventional. Over to you, Wes, into XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I would like to invite Dr. Voigt. He's probably waiting. I spoke to him before. Well, we have three modes, so that will be TM, TE, and TM. So TM already you described. The TE mode is no electric field in the direction of propagation. It is being called H mode because there is only magnetic field along the direction of propagation. The transverse magnetic, which is TM, and T was transverse electric, no magnetic field in the direction of propagation. Now, we have a statement, and I would like to point that why he thinks he's right, and by that, maybe it helps. Let me jump, and maybe Dr. Roy is also ready. Let me jump.
AC2GS here.
Go right ahead. Wait for the beeps and give us your impression of those articles, though, Roy. You've got it, Roy.
As I wrote you in the email, it sounds very interesting. I'm pretty much in agreement with you. I think the 2 decibel loss is radiative loss, but, you know, he didn't really tell you. He had two experiments. One was 35 feet of a wire, and the other was 350 feet of wire, and he quoted 2 decibel loss for both of those. So the inference is that the wire itself isn't producing a great deal of the loss. So whether it's radiative or resistive, I don't know, and he didn't mention. But, you know, it sounded interesting to me, and I agree that the pointing vector is not the same as a magnetic field or an electric field that's longitudinal.
What is the behavior of TM modes?
That's in waveguides, I'm sure, but I don't know about this E-line of the gentleman.
It's a problem, because the TM mode is directly directly related to the waveguide, and Dr. Roy made it right, I believe. He said, maybe an air surrounding acts as a slowing medium. Dick.
Yeah, with the data he has presented, it's an interesting set of experiments at 35 feet, 300 feet, and he got what he believed to be fairly broadband, fairly low insertion loss of that transmission line. But that insertion loss is low if and only if you assign 2 dB of loss for the launching structure and 2 dB of loss for the receiving launching structure. And he didn't explain where those 2 dB came from. And if he's made out of copper sheet like he did in his photographs, that doesn't explain the loss. And if it's radiated loss, then it's radiation of a signal that's not necessarily flowing down the wire. It's a radiated loss of another kind of signal in free space, which implies that the loss, that the transmission line is not very well shielded, and it's going to be creating interference to nearby equipment. So because of the degree of difficulty of creating this great big catenary for supporting the transmission line, and because of these apparent losses and leakages of the launching structures, I'm not convinced that a whole lot of hams or technologists are going to jump on this bandwagon with the experiments he's presented so far. And maybe as he goes further with his experiments, some of these extra loss characteristics maybe will be explained. But I wonder if you agree with me, Roy, that with the data he presented, it's fun to look at and speculate about, but I don't see him presenting enough data that a whole lot of people are going to want to go start using that. AC2GS for some comments. K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Roy.
AC2GS. Yeah, it's a great tinkering concept. It's novel. I don't quite understand why it's different than the G-line. I realize G-lines usually have a higher dielectric, but You know, air has some degree of a dielectric, so couldn't you say that it's just a peculiar case of a G-line?
My understanding of G-line, Roy, is that there's a certain required minimum thickness of a certain dielectric constant of dielectric material wrapped around the wire. There's a certain minimum requirement for that dielectric material to contain the wave that travels down the G-line. But a completely bare piece of wire with no dielectric material, I believe, is not G-line, and it is not supporting the mode of propagation of a normal G-line. So he's got something different. He did mention that the 10,000th of an inch, that's my word, rust on the outside of the wire. I think he was speculating that that was the missing dielectric material, and my understanding of G-line, that's nowhere near enough thickness. So he's got a piece of wire. He's calling in the transmission line. Yes, he's admitting it's not G-line, and we are all coming to the conclusion he hasn't met the usual minimum requirement for thickness of dielectric material to call it a G-line. So he's got
number.
So he's got some other kind of line. What did he call that line, Wes? And now that he's calling it a TM structure, is he implying that the TM transmission line has lower loss than that same diameter and weight of wire being used in some other manner? And is he trying to imply that this is a very desirable kind of transmission line that we should all should start considering using it? N2XJN, wait for the beeps, K2LIW.
It will be a requirement for you to explain also what TM0M is, or TM behavior is in that matter. That would be also related to TM00 wave. Why he says this is not the global line? Let me jump. The concentration of field is involved. Conductor does not require conditions. The TM00 wave cannot travel at sea. Bare conductor can work well below 5 GHz, even HF. And we know from global line that over 1 MHz up, that would be the higher frequency, the better it works. And in some literature, I found that the best frequency for that operation would be the 50 to 150 gigahertz. Let me jump. Okay. So, global requires slowing to wave down by means of insulation or special conditions. He says he doesn't need it. There was a patent in 1954. And it stated that reduced wave propagation velocity, special conductor, no bare wires, and launchers with mouse considerable fraction of wavelength, which is not required there, and no low frequency operation. Now, you forgot, guys, about those special rings. So, if Dr. Roy, please.
Yeah, so I just assumed it was part of his launcher array. That, you know, he tells people that this is the mechanism from shifting the coax from TM mode to TM north-north mode. I just thought it was part of the same mechanism. He has a lot of conical sections that feed coax in his article.
We don't have the key yet. Well, Bebo invented the method for launching and receiving electrical energy from the transmission line. That was a ring that could serve also as the bottom of the cone. That was having a hole, and the disc may be a base of the cone with its narrow end connected typically to the shield of coaxial feed line, and the transmission line itself connected to the center of conductor of coax. However, our gentleman, Glenn, did it differently. Thank you, Joe. Okay. I'm trying to get it to start. Hold
up. W2SAW.
Before I go there, the comment that he sent to me, I'm afraid Goebel got it wrong. I gave a great deal of evidence supporting and explaining this, but to put it only very briefly, Goebel presented a premise necessary to slow surface wave on the single conductor down into the order to prevent radiation and allow launchers of reasonable size. He followed this with some mathematics, and the premises and the statement are simply not true. Okay, the wave I described is a TM wave, so we really have a Goebel as a reference, but we don't have a statement saying this is Goebel. So the wave I described, it means Glenn, the TM wave having longitudinal E field. And then he takes the reference to Stratton electromagnetic theory from MIT 1941 that shows that a very generous sense, considering cylindrical media and structures, there were two principal modes possible, TEM00 and TAM00. A TEM00 mode, normally the only mode considered to exist in common coaxial cable, but in reality both modes exist as a hybrid. So the impedance is high. The TM00 mode is extremely small. It has been missed entirely until recently. In a vacuum, the wave propagates at C. I have measured very nearly that in air. In fact, I have made reasonable measurement on dielectric constant of air this way. So back to you, Dick.
And we had somebody who signed in that maybe wants to make a comment on this. Blank, blank, number 2SAW. Give me the full call letter, sir, and your name, and then proceed with your question or comment. Mr. SAW, K2LIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. My name is Bill, W2SAW. Sorry to break in on this, but I was just noticing that the Limark signal is, for me, is about 40 to 60 dB below what it normally is with lots of fluctuation. I was just wondering if this was me or you had some idea what was going on.
If I understood what you said correctly, Bill, I think you're saying that the signal from Limark to your house tonight and where are you located, and you're saying the signal is 40 to 50 or 60 dB weaker than normal. Where are you located, and is that what you're saying, Bill? Back to you, Bill.
Yes, that's correct, Dick. I'm located in Manhattan. I usually read the repeater about 60 dB over 9. Right now, I'm reading it as just an S9 to S20 with lots of fluctuation.
Yeah, and your location in Manhattan, I know there are probably some nearby buildings, and you're probably at an altitude much lower than those buildings, so you're getting a signal that's bouncing all kinds of crazy ways, and I think you're seeing an example of multipath. In other words, the way the signal bounces between all of those buildings and finally gets to you, if your antenna was movable, I guarantee you would see all kinds of peaks and valleys. Very similar to an experiment you could run, Bill. You take your handy-talkie in your room, listening to the Limark repeater with your handy-talkie, and as you translate the handy-talkie in the X, Y, and Z direction, and then tilt it in various directions, horizontal and vertical, and the rubber duck aimed toward the repeater, as you do all those experiments, you'll see tremendous differences in signal strength. That's what multipath is doing. And so whatever antenna you're receiving tonight off of those wet buildings that had some snow on them yesterday are giving you a different kind of reflection that happens to be giving you a cancellation. That's a guess on my part that may be taking place. I'm having trouble believing that Eric's transmitter is 50 or 60 decibels weaker tonight
and we're all hearing it. So as you can tell, that doesn't correlate. So I wonder if you've ever done that experiment with your handy-talkie, Bill, and if you have the ability to move your current receiving antenna, or if you had a second receiving antenna you flip over to, I think you'd see a very different signal strength. Whiskey 2, Sierra Alpha Whiskey, K2LIW. You got it, Bill.
Well, I just have a mobile radio with a 5/8 wave antenna on a air conditioner. It's always in the same position. And every once in a while, this does happen. Normally, I read you with the exact same setup at 60 dB over, but every once in a while, I almost completely lose the signal without changing anything in my setup. And tonight, it seems to be happening again.
And it's my guess that that's something very local to your environment, Bill. If you could take that antenna and translate it to a different location, I think you'd see a very different signal strength. Whenever you've got a heavy multipath environment, like you've got with the reflection of all those buildings of the marble canyons you live in Manhattan, periodically you're going to see very different signal strength because of all those signals combining in a different way. You probably have 30 different radio paths by which that signal is getting to you. And those 30 paths are all beating against each other. Sometimes they come out all in phase and you get a nice strong signal. And sometimes a certain percentage of them are out of phase and you get a canceled signal. That's a guess on my part as to what I think is happening. So you've got a beautiful example there of the craziness of the what's called Rayleigh fading statistics of multipath reception. So it would be interesting if you could put up a second antenna in your environment and periodically flip back and forth between the two antennas, and from time to time you're going to see some very large signal strength difference, very similar to what you would do with a handy talkie. Have you ever used a handy talkie inside of your building and walk around with it, raising it, lowering it, pushing it forward, pushing it left and right, and twisting it in polarization? Have you ever seen the way the signal you get on the handy talkie goes up and down in crazy ways? Over to you, Bill. W2SAW, K2LAW.
Well, I don't have a handy talkie. I do have a scanner, and sometimes just walking around with the scanner, I've seen that. My scanner from inside here doesn't really pick up line mark. But in your last transmission, I dropped down to an S7 and you dropped out off my radio altogether for a few seconds. So but it's probably the multipath and the weather.
It's got to be multipath and weather because I'm watching the signal strength coming out of the repeater right now. And I'm not seeing any change in signal strength, whereas you're seeing a huge signal strength changes. So the multipath tonight is just not favoring you. A lot of those signals are coming out of phase with each other and giving you a partial cancellation. So translating your antenna would make a huge improvement. Whether you go to higher, more to the east, more to the west, more to the north, more to the south, and change in polarization. When I'm listening to this repeater on my handy talkie in my bathroom while I'm shaving in the morning, I get the strongest signal from this repeater with my handy talkie horizontal. It's laying on a plastic shelf horizontal. When I put my handy talkie vertical, I hear less signal. By the time the signal from this repeater bounces around my neighborhood and gets into my bathroom, it happens to be a primarily horizontally polarized signal, even though it started off as a purely vertical signal at the Glen Oaks, the transmitting site. That's some of the craziness of multipath. Okay, Wes, I believe that I believe you feel quite a bit of enthusiasm for Glenn N6 Golf November for his experiments with his Jabu-like line, the single wire transmission line. You believe that he's onto something desirable, and I think you're saying that we should give it more consideration. He might be onto something here. And as you can tell, Roy and I are a little bit skeptical that it's not the is not the the best transmission line in the world yet. And he's got this mysterious 2 dB of loss on each end that hasn't been explained. And so if I take away the 4 dB, what he claims for his launching structures, then the total insertion loss of his line is not so desirable, even though, yes, one simple wire line is a nice, inexpensive way of using a transmission line, but Roy and I would be asking the question, how well shielded is it? Am I going to be getting interference with other pieces of nearby electronics? And is the insertion loss he's claiming really as good as he claims, considering the loss he thinks is coming from his launching structures? Do you believe you would like to start using his kind of transmission line, though, Wes? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet?
The major point why I decided to pay attention to that was longitudinal E-line, the E-field component. Because now we have a property of longitudinal component behaving the way that longitudinal wave behaves. And I could go to the literature to go further with it. What I could do is I could invite N6GN to the TechNet by himself. Now, we still didn't go over a structure that he built. Let me go. It's a circular brass disc folded and soldered so as to create a 90 degrees cone. An SMA book head connector was soldered to the narrow end of the cone, and at the same time, a length of the bare copper conductor used for narrow end of the cone, and the same type of length of bare copper conductor used for was also presented in the paper that I have sent to you. So the two measurements have been made, and one was with those which you forgot, guys, to mention, discs that were on the wire, let me drop. A small polyethylene dielectric compensator to help reduce discontinuity and consequent reflection and radiation. The compensator was fabricated from approximately 30 millimeters long section of polyethylene dielectric removed from conventional RG8 coaxial cable and placed a few millimeters away from SMA connector. The material was removed to us to a taper the diameter of the compensator linearly from the wire diameter at each end to maximum diameter of 8 millimeters in its middle. And he was making a number of measurements. From what I understood, the higher frequency, the better. There is a number of scientific articles standing about higher frequencies. You still didn't go to the TM modes or TE modes. Its behavior, you could explain what TM00 means. But if you think that it's enough for tonight, I would be glad if you give me okay to talk to N6GN and appear on the TechNet network show. Maybe Roy has a few words.
Go ahead, Roy.
It's fascinating stuff, and I'm not exactly sure about that disc, because it depends on what article you read of Mr. Elmore's. I was reading his first article in QEX, where he really describes that disc as a support to a piece of styrofoam and doesn't go into the impedance aspects of it. So, you know, maybe it's an article later on where he's discovered that tweaking the styrofoam for another material would be beneficial to him. But, you know, I think it's fascinating. I think it's more of something to play with, especially for amateurs, because why do we, you know, particularly need that type of a transmission line? It has its own problems. You know, he's proposing some commercial aspect of high bandwidth data transmission on power lines using this technology, which sounds fascinating as long as it doesn't cause interference like the last idea of power line data involved.
Yeah, I have a few words to it.
Yeah, digital over power lines was something that's been experimented with, and the power lines are not nice, simple structures. Yes, the piece of wire is there, but periodically you've got the line dropping transformers, and what's that going to be doing to your signal? And the attempts to put radio signals on power lines in order to get digital information into rural areas that don't have coax cable or don't have fiber cable. On paper, it sounds good, but the experiments that have done to date on putting radio signals on power lines have not been very desirable, and the leakage from them creates an awful lot of local interference. Back to you, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
The interesting point for me was that he have made a 300 feet distance over the number 28 wires, transferring, if I remember, 100 watts, but I may be wrong, with 2-3 watts of loss. And that's what he shows on the bird meter. That was on the video. Maybe Roy remembers the best, but as I say, the longitudinal part of E field. If we go to that, if we go to the magnetic force behavior in the matter, it would be much longer discussion. We still didn't touch longitudinal magnetic field. Dr. Roy.
Well, again, Wesley, I don't really think that the longitudinal electric field can be manifested in free space. There's nothing to prove that. It can exist in waveguides. It may exist in Elmore's E line. I don't know, but they're two separate things. Free space is a different thing than any kind of conductive media.
We're really talking about the free space here. We have two cones. Dick.
Wes, you are saying that he had a 300-foot lens with only a couple of watts loss at the 100-watt level. If he had a couple of watts, 2 or 3 watts of loss at the 100-watt level, that would be an insertion loss of minus 0.13 dB. He can't be claiming 0.13 dB of overall transmission loss when he claims he's got 2 dB of loss on the input launching structure and 2 dB of loss on the output launching structure. The numbers are not coming out right. There was another person joining us. Who was that? Give me your full call letters and name. K2LIW. My name is Dick. We're listening.
Hi, Dick. It's George, KD2FIU. I'm listening to what I understand is data over power lines, and industry has been talking about it for years. But sooner or later, if that were to occur, somebody's going to be in your home, at a party, at your house, standing next to your refrigerator, and coming up with something to hack your computer.
He had a tungsten load on the end of the line, 300 feet.
Okay, with that tungsten load, are you saying he had 2 or 3 watts of loss at the 100-watt level through the total transmission system? Is that what you believe he was saying, Wes, over the U.S.?
It's on his video. He has only 5 videos, 4 of them are related. He has also presented a balloon where he used a that kind of transmission line to eventually transmit over the mountain, and he showed how he can power the drone constantly with no battery involved using that method, and that's on his videos. You could see it by yourself. Now, is it 100 watt? I have to check it out. Maybe Dr. Roy remembers better. Dr. Roy.
It was my understanding that the loss did not include the 2 decibels at both launchers. So that's where the loss, you know, that's where the decibels don't get counted up correctly. So he claims approximately 2 watts of loss over 350 feet, forgetting about the 2 decibel loss at the first launcher and the 2 decibel loss at the second launcher.
And he did give an example of using this as a repeating system. In other words, the piece of wire that's supporting a balloon, a helium-filled balloon, for instance, could be the transmission line that sends a signal up to the balloon. The balloon, with its high altitude, allows you to send the signal over the nearby mountain and getting it into the valley of the guy on the other side of that mountain. So this is a nice passive repeating system, if you could make it work. And so that's a possible mode of operation. However, that kind of a repeater, although it's an interesting experiment, wouldn't work very well 365 days of the year where you have ice, snow, rain, and wind. Almost any kind of a helium-filled balloon tethered to the ground, the whole structure is going to be laying parallel to the ground on a heavy, windy day. So although on paper this looks very desirable as an experiment, as a viable structure to be used 24/7, it may not fulfill the requirements that we really need. N2XJN, K2LIW.
That's interesting what you said, and I agree with you. However, the idea of having a drone instead of 20 minutes or 30 minutes, what the drone is right now available to do, say a few months in the air, it could be good for defense, it could be good for security, for any kind of applications, even for filming of changes in the grass or environment. And he shows clearly on his video that he is able to power electrical motor. Apart from that he showed up to 300 feet, a tungsten light bulb being powered, and to actually...
Yeah, even if we had a tethered drone up in the air as a passive repeater system, even that drone would be able to fight the wind a little bit better than a helium-filled balloon, but on a icy, sleety day, even that system is not going to give you a complete coverage, if you know what I mean. So to put up drone-like devices powered by the tethering wire, and that's the way you send the power up to it, and maybe the signal, as an experiment, it's a fun thing to do. But as a viable commercial product, it's got some problems that haven't yet been solved, as I see it, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, I mean, if you agree, I can contact Glenn and ask him if he would be able to participate in the TechNet. He would be able to say it by himself. But talking about the losses that we have right now on the power lines versus the losses that he's experiencing it's a day-night, we know that we have a certain vulnerability. I see it from different perspective. For me, anything that is longitudinal within something that is caused by transversal signal or wave or whatever is something that makes me think that what Dr. Roy said, and I would like to address this question to you. Is it really transversal in full meaning of it? Maybe Dr. Roy would be able to word better. Dr. Roy?
I'm not 100% sure what the question is. I assume what really interests you is the longitudinal aspect of the electric field. Because, you know, you're very interested in longitudinal EM waves, which I don't believe in either. I'm thinking that you want clarification for the transverse magnetic mode explanation. That would be my guess.
That would be good guess. Dick.
Yeah, as Roy and I review W-2 and 6GN's material, there's quite a bit of missing information. The biggest piece of missing information is that the huge insertion loss, 2 dB on each end from the launching structures, has not been explained. If N6GN came up,